content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the March 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we'll begin with an article titled, Pi is a Constant. In Naples, the Formula Calls for Pizza, by Franz Lids. During those first few weeks of the COVID-19 outbreak, the Rome newspaper Il Foglio ran a panicky headline that proclaimed La Morte del Bacio, the death of kissing. In the age of social distancing, Italians wondered if smooching would soon go the way of the Roman Empire. 140 miles down the coast, in Naples, where restaurants were twice shut down in lengthy lockdowns, natives mulled a more existential threat, la morte della pizza. Would the virus be the Neapolitan pie's kiss of death? Faced with a financial meltdown of Pompeian proportion, the pizzerias of Naples tweaked their centuries-old business models to fit the moment, ushering in such previously blasphemous practices as home delivery and, heaven forfend, pizza kits. Eating pizza is not a Naples norm that will be upended by the pandemic, maintains Luca Del Fra, an official with Italy's cultural ministry. Pizza is economical, it's fast, it's Naples, so I doubt the public will forget. Naples is the birthplace and, as any Neapolitan will tell you, the spiritual homeland of pizza. In this southern Italian city of 963,000 people and 8,200 pizzerias, it's said that fathers want their sons to be one of two things: soccer players for SSC Napoli or pizza chefs, called pizzaioli, or in the local dialect, pizzauli. There are 15,000 pizzaioli in Naples, and the virtuosos are like pop stars, admired, even revered, with fervent followers who seldom stop arguing about their favorite place's place in pizzaioli pantheon. All Neapolitan pizza makers think they are the best in the city, even if all their relatives are Neapolitan pizza makers, says Francesco Salvo, whose grandfather, father, and two brothers are pizza chefs too. The essence of Neapolitan pizza is family sharing its passion. Your execution must be meticulous, because if you let quality slip, you are cheating on your family tradition, which is like cheating on your wife. The exacting standards of those pizzaioli are responsible for changing the perception of the fare from a humble pie into a deeply respected cuisine. The classic Neapolitan pizza is as soft and fluffy as a basset hound's ears. It's chewy rather than crunchy, with a moist, if not soupy, top, abundant scorch marks, leoparding, and an airy coroncione, the pillowy ledge that frames the crust. The steamy crust is blast-cooked to perfection in 90 seconds, or less, at about 900 degrees, almost double the temperature of most American pizza ovens, and is thinner than the plate it's served on. What most distinguishes Neapolitan pizza is the ferocious heat in which it's cooked and the soft, supple pliability of the dough, says Zach Pollock, chef and owner of Cosa Buono, a Naples-inspired pizzeria in Los Angeles. Everything is about the dough. When a pie is so dough-centric, you get a totally different outcome than if the toppings are the focus of the event. Consisting of only water, salt, yeast, and highly refined wheat flour, Neapolitan dough is the most elemental of all formulas, but the apparent simplicity hides a great complexity. The maestros allow their dough to ferment anywhere from 12 hours to several days. The only thing that keeps it from levitating above their heads are gently oozing splodges of buffalo mozzarella from the marshland of the southern Apennines and the blobs of pulpy plum tomatoes grown in the volcanic soil of Mount Vesuvius. This combination of bright acidity and sweet, cheesy smoothness inhabits the taste space that Japanese called umami, or pleasant, savory flavor. A Neapolitan pie is designed to be consumed fresh and hot, as close as possible to the igloo-shaped oven in which it was cooked. Perhaps the pie's most important virtue is digeribilità, digestibility, a charming term for pizzas that are easy to eat and that your body welcomes with seeming effortlessness. Though some American pizzerias reach those lofty heights, most Americans buy their pizzas frozen or eat them at churn-and-burn pie chains. The dough has been turbo-boosted with sugar to rise quickly, and an unctuous sea of cheese and meat has been piled atop rubbery, underdone, or brittle, overdone crusts, sometimes occurring in the same pizza. The quality of the tomato sauce? Not a consideration. Frankly, what passes for pizza abroad is all too often a travesty. Neapolitan pizziolo Ciro Maffa has lamented, enough is enough. Neapolitan pizza is not just a source of Epicurean pleasure and civic pride. Its preparation is considered an art form, one that 4 years ago UNESCO, the United Nations cultural arm, elevated to intangible cultural heritage status alongside such practices as Indian yoga, South Korean tightrope walking, and Burundi's ritual dance of the royal drum. Ironically, Naples' treasured intangibles are made tangible every day in pretty much every major city on Earth. But despite dozens of regional adjustments, think the tomato pies of New Jersey, the pizza of New Haven, the Provolone cheese and crackers of St. Louis, no variation, no matter how delicious, is as central to the local culture as pizza surely is to Naples. Pizza here is thoroughly rooted in the community life, says Gino Sorbiglio, whose eponymous Naples pizza place has offshoots in Milan, New York, Rome, Tokyo, Miami, Genoa, and soon Abu Dhabi. It's the soft warmth of the Mediterranean sun. It's the violence of Vesuvius. It's the great moments of humanity the city offers at every street corner. In Naples, pizza is more than just food. It's the identity of the people. 400 years ago, Caravaggio revolutionized painting with a chiaroscuro style reflecting the splendor and squalor of Naples. Brightness and light contrasted with the blackness of deep, menacing shadow. It's a dark, enchanted city, the American actor and director John Turturro told me. His 2010 documentary, Passione, is a rapturous celebration of Neapolitan music. When Odysseus' ship stopped nearby on the way back from the Trojan War, the sorceress Circe mixed a magic potion that turned most of his crew into swine. Today the natives call their hometown La Strega, the witch, and say, come to Naples, lose your mind, and then die. They're fatalistic, and yet the coffee and the pizza have to be perfect. Sprawling and endlessly vibrant, Naples marries joyous confusion with a sense of mild danger. The city's insalubrious reputation derives from its recent history of mounting garbage, ceaseless traffic, and the depredations of one of Italy's oldest organized crime syndicates, the Camorra, whose moped-straddling banditos zoom the wrong way down the medieval warren of one-way streets. Along those narrow alleyways, wrought iron balconies drip with buntings of faded laundry, and walls are buried beneath layers of posters, graffiti, and grime. In the belly of old Naples squats Antica Pizzeria Portalba, the world's oldest pizza parlor. Portalba was established in 1738 as an open-air stand for peddlers who got their pies from the city's bakeries and kept them warm in small tinned copper stoves balanced on their heads. The stand expanded to a restaurant with chairs and tables in 1830, replacing many of the street vendors. 12 years later, Ferdinand II of the Two Sicilies, otherwise known as King Nazone, Big Nose, came incognito to the pizzeria to survey the mood of his people. The king probably ordered all'olio e pomodoro, says Gennaro Luciano, the current proprietor. That's the pizza topped with tomato sauce, oil, oregano and garlic that's commonly called marinara, derived from La Marinara, the fisherman's wife, who typically prepared the dish for her husband when he returned from trawling in the Bay of Naples. Luciano is a sixth-generation pizzaiolo with shambling charm and a studiously unkempt style. Neapolitan pizza making is not acrobatic, he says flatly. No flipping, no juggling, no DJing, just the art lavorazione, the way the dough is worked. The art informs every aspect of Luciano's technique. From kneading and flattening, he says the dough has to be amacata, crushed, to the blister and a puff of a pie's cornicione. He's explaining this between bites of a pizza a portafoglio, literally a wallet pizza that has been folded in half and then in quarters. Since the tomato sauce is gathered and protected in the folds, Luciano recommends holding the pie out away from your shirt front. Portalba claims to have invented this portable street food, and for nearly three centuries has stocked the 8-inch mini pies in a display case by the entrance. Without the glass case, Pizzeria Portalba would no longer be the Pizzeria Portalba, says Luciano. Customers stopped by in to buy portafoglio when they were students. Now they return with their grandchildren. Luciano is 59 and has been making pizzas for the last 46 of those years. He's packed with an endless supply of pizza lore, which he retails more or less nonstop for hours, pausing only to stoke the fire in the back of Portalba's lava-lined oven with kindling and small chunks of oak. He says that not far from his pizzeria, in the Greco-Roman ruins beneath the 18th-century cloister at San Lorenzo Maggiore, are the remains of a 1st-century A.D. Roman market, a shopping arcade, and a proto-Neapolitan pizza oven. Similar baking chambers with hollow spaces to insulate hot air, drafts for smoke, and terracotta tile floors were found during excavations at nearby Pompeii and Herculaneum. Inside some were loaves of bread preserved in charcoal, covered in ash, and stamped to identify the baker. One 2,000-year-old loaf was divided into 8 wedges and inscribed, Celer, slave of Quintus Granius Ferus. The story of pizza, says Luciano, dates to Neolithic times, when tribes baked a crude batter on the stones of their campfires. The Neapolitan variant was the product of 2 cultures, Greek and Etruscan. The Greek city-states feasted on plakos, a flat and round cheese pie with a rim of crust that served as a kind of handle. From the 8th century to the 5th century BC, the Greeks colonized the coastal areas of southern Italy that made up Magna Graecia, bringing their edible plates along. It had been speculated that pita, the English word for a flat, hollow, unleavened bread, had etymological roots in pitke, the ancient Greek term for fermented pastry, which in turn passed to Latin as picta, hence pizza. At about the same time, says Luciano, the Etruscans left Asia Minor and settled in the northern and central parts of Italy. Their pizza dough precursor was a sort of grain mush baked in stones beneath cooking ashes and topped with herbs and seasoned oils. After swallowing Etruscan folkways whole, the Romans renamed the ash cakes panis focaceus, fireplace flour bread, which evolved into focaccia. Luciano grabs a tomato from a ceramic bowl, holds it aloft, and sinks his teeth into the fleshy pulp. This changed the face of flatbread, he says. The tomato gave Neapolitans the right to claim pizza as our own. In the early 16th century, Spanish conquistadors returned from the New World with an exotic yellow cherry-sized fruit that the Aztecs called the tomato. Fear and loathing were quick to follow. In 1544, the Italian botanist and physician Pietro Mattioli was the first to formally classify the plant, likening it to a cross between mandrake and deadly nightshade, both poisonous. Soon the tomato was tarred with the Latin name Lycopersicum, literally wolf peach. Wolf because of its alleged toxicity, peach due to its shape and texture. Word spread that wealthy people got sick and died after consuming tomatoes. and for some 200 years, most Europeans avoided them like the plague, which incidentally nearly eradicated the population of Naples during the mid-1600s. As it turns out, says Luciano, it was all a big misunderstanding. The wealthy ate their food off pewter, an alloy with a high lead content. Combined with the tomato's acidity, the flat layer would leach lead, sometimes resulting in the diner's death. The poor, on the other hand, used plates made of wood. They could eat tomatoes and not get sick, he says. It wasn't until the invention of pizza, somewhere in the early 1700s, that tomatoes began to gain wider acceptance. Pizza took a little longer. Though it nourished the poor of Naples, who substituted tomato sauce for meat, the piquant dish wasn't to everyone's liking. Samuel Morse, inventor of the telegraph, described pizza, which he had sampled on a visit in 1831, as a species of most nauseating cake, not unlike a piece of bread that had been taken reeking out of the sewer. The 19th century slight elicits a laugh from Luciano. Oven logs crackle continuously in a low, ominous mutter as he pads through the age-softened galley, occasionally lifting up the crusts of pies to check that they are properly cooked, elastic but not limp and not burned like toast. The magical breakthrough of pizza came in 1889, he says. That was when Queen Margherita of Savoy, consort of King Umberto I, observed peasants in Naples enjoying the people's food. Supposedly, the queen summoned the city's most famous pizzaiolo, Raphael Esposito, to the royal residence on Capodimonte Hill and had him prepare three pizzas for her. This was 28 years after the unification of Italy, and the pie she liked best bore the colors of the new national flag, tomato red, mozzarella white, and basil green. So pleased was Her Highness that she sent Esposito a letter of thanks. So flattered was Esposito that he named this tricolor sensation the Margherita. At that moment, pizza conquered the world, Luciano says. The patron saint of Neapolitan pies is Sophia Loren, who grew up just outside the city. Her canonization was propelled by the 1954 movie L'Oro di Napoli, The Gold of Naples, in which she played a seller of pizza fritti, deep-fried half-moon pockets stuffed with ricotta and crispy bits of fatty pork. Though Neapolitan pizza-making is dominated by men, the wives of pizzaioli play a key role after World War II, hawking fried pizza, the original pie born before the oven-baked variety, to the poor. Standing before an oven was an arduous task, so making traditional pies was a man's job, explains Isabella de Com, Naples' most renowned female pizzaiolo. Instead of costly mozzarella, fried pizza used common ingredients and was smaller in size, which made it easier for feminine hands to fold. L'Antica Pizzeria de Michel, a storefront operation, is tucked behind the 14th century Duomo in the working-class Forcella neighborhood. The peppery scent of basil and the aroma of warm dough precede the place, a pair of dining rooms watched over by a statue of St. Antonio Abate, the patron saint of bakers, enshrined in a neon-lit glass cabinet. Da Michel is the most determinedly traditional of all of Naples' pizzerias. Paterfamilias Salvador Condoro got his license to make pizza in 1870. He prepared and sold fried pizza on the street outside his home. Since 1930, when his son Michel opened the family's first pizza emporium, the Condoros have been turning out marinaras and margaritas and nothing else. The waiters, whose white polo shirts bear the phrase El Tempio della Pizza, the Temple of Pizza, dismiss all other forms as papocci, Neapolitan slang for phony tricks. 36 years ago, the Associazione Verace Pizza Napoletana, AVPM, established by the city's 17 most prominent pizza-making families, set up a protocol to promote and protect the reputation of true Neapolitan pizza. Accordingly, any pizzeria that wants to display the association's logo, and in Naples only 125, less than 2% have made the grade, must make its marinaras and margaritas, the only official civic pizzas, from hand-kneaded dough, no rolling pins, that should be cajoled into a disc not to exceed 13.8 inches across and baked in a wood-fired brick oven. The cornicione must not rise above 4/5 of an inch. For all their pizza purism, Da Michele's pizzaioli seem to revel in flouting conventions. Rather than extra virgin olive oil, they use cheaper vegetable oil. Instead of mozzarella made from the milk of water buffaloes, they use a cow's milk alternative, which they insist maintains its soft consistency better in the intense dry heat of the ovens. Da Michele's amoeba-like pies overflow the plate, and you're not sure whether to feed them or keep them as pets. The Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop and says, "Can you make me one with everything?" Of all the chefs dreaming up ethereal Neapolitan pizzas, none is as learned as Enzo Coccia. His pie-making academy in Naples' affluent Vomera district lures pilgrims from great distances, all seeking red sauce enlightenment. Coccia's disciple, Daniele Uditi, a Pisana in Los Angeles, says no other chef is so analytical. Enzo thinks about pizza from an intellectual perspective. He changed the way modern pies are made and brought respectability to the craft. Quiet and professorial, Coccia, who's 58, has dabbled in chemistry, anthropology, and physics to better understand what he calls the delicate dance of assembling a proper Neapolitan pizza. "I can see a pizza from across the room and diagnose what is wrong with it," says Coccia. La Pizza Napoletana, the handbook he co-wrote in 2015, bubbles over with sprightly entries such as, "The quantity of heat transferred from the floor of the oven to the pizza is given in the equation Q cond equals K A parentheses TB minus TIMP parentheses closed." Coccia began working at his family's trattoria near the Napoli Centrale station at the age of 8, and he now runs the school and two pizzerias, most notably Notizia. He launched the city's new pizza movement in 1994, becoming the first pizzaiolo to experiment with dough using a variety of flours and lengthy proving times. Among the surprising flavor combinations on his more avant-garde pies, eggplants and mint burrata, broad beans and asparagus, and lemon, licorice, and zucchini pesto. Pepperoni, an American invention, is a Naples no-no. Yet, he cautions, a pizzaiolo should not combine more top-of-the-line garnishes than is absolutely necessary. A terrible pizza chef who uses excellent raw materials will produce terrible pizzas, and an excellent pizza chef who uses terrible raw materials will also produce terrible pizzas. Nothing is more critical than the quality of ingredients. Except maybe the baking chamber. Coccia notes that Neapolitan pizza ovens have unique thermal properties, incorporating three means of heat transfer: conduction, convection, and radiation. The brick floor cooks the pie by direct contact, or conduction. The curved interior circulates hot air throughout the chamber, convection, and heat absorbed into the masonry radiates from the dome. Radiant heat is what actually cooks the pizza. Because the heat waves come from so many angles, the temperature of the cooking surface isn't uniform. Every oven has hot spots, Coccia allows. The pizzaiolo must be familiar enough with the oven's quirks to eye a pie and know where to move it next. With a single pizza, no problem. But when you bake 4 or 5 at once, anyone less than a master is like to cremate them all. Like many restaurants in Italy, the pizzerias of Naples were hit hard by the pandemic. Many parlors survived a 3-month spring lockdown on the back of Cassa Integrazione, a government program that covers up to 80% of employees' wages for companies that apply and are accepted into the relief scheme. The plight of the pizzerias were also partly alleviated by a Heal Italy decree that suspended loan and mortgage repayments for companies and families, thanks to state guarantees for banks and increased funds to help firms pay laid-off workers. Kacha reports that during the first COVID-19 wave, the money brought in by carryout, deliveries were prohibited, wasn't even enough to cover his staff's salaries, let alone his overhead costs. He estimates that his business was down some 75%. The outlook got rosier over the summer, but on October 25th, after coronavirus deaths in Italy had tripled in a month, the state imposed a strict curfew. Restaurants were forced to close at 6 p.m. and could only offer takeout. The pizzas that Kacha concocted for home delivery during the pandemic's second wave require lower oven temperatures and longer cooking times, making for a slightly drier pie. "We will continue with home deliveries and takeaway," he says, "but always giving the priority to customers at the table." I asked Kacha to name a Neapolitan pizzaiolo at the pinnacle of his profession. "Attilio Bacchetti," he says without hesitation. He makes the lightest, most digestible pizza there is. And that is where we will conclude with this article, and we'll pick up this article again on next week's program. We've run out of time on today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.